watch me cry. Stand up on mighty Priam and say you rise.
Hello and welcome to Foundations for Life. This is Barry Phillips along with my esteemed co-host Mike Clayton. We are live. We are ready. We have prayed. We're ready for this Torah portion. Best of luck. And we invite you to go ahead and get your text out to the book of Shemot, or perhaps you would say Exodus chapter 13 and verse 17. And Mike, we got a good one tonight. It's some good stuff going on. Well, they're all good, but some of them are good ones.
Yeah, some of them are just a little gooder than others. And I think we're in one of the gooder ones, because this is about a people that are coming out of bondage. And Barry, if there's anything that is speaking to me these days, is this account. I'm not going to call it a story. I don't like Bible stories, because that's like, you know, Aesop's fables. These are accounts, real accounts of what happened to real people when they came out of a real land of bondage into freedom. The struggles, the trials they went through, the victories, everything is written for us to learn from them so that we don't to make the same mistakes again. But, this is just these Torah portions. There's an excitement this year that I have about these. You know, you go from Moshe, probably a bit timid, walking in. Even though he's been to a burning bush, it's like, okay, what's going to happen here? And he throws that staff down, and miracles begin to happen. It's a wild ride for what has been said to be about a year. That year is over, and all of a sudden, Pharaoh says, you guys get out of here. I'm done with you. I don't want to see you again. Get out of this place. And so here we have the exile has been reversed. And they're heading home.
Having no clue the intensity of what's in front of them.
Oh, no.
You know, it wasn't originally planned, designed, or intended to be a 40-year process.
They changed
the specs on the creator themselves, but that we'll get to that. As you were describing Moshe at the burning bush and throwing down the rod and wondering what's going to happen next, the thought just came to me: are we prepared for what he's about to do? How much preparation do we lack? And there is at some point, ready or not, here we go. So when Pharaoh makes the decree after the death of the firstborn that they are to leave, was there a Yahoo or was it an oh me? Now what do we do? You know? So I had this question. So when he let Am Yisrael go, it wasn't so much you may now leave as it was y'all get out.
Mm-hmm.
They were being demanded and kicked out, demanded to leave, thrown out, kicked out, and forced out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, a majority of them, I don't know that a majority of them stayed, or perhaps a majority of them had already died in the plague of the darkness when their hearts were still rebellious. But when our exile is over, regardless of what country or geographical area that we're in, are we going to get offended that we're told to leave? Or are we going to see that as Yah's plan? It's time to go.
That's probably one of the places for the infamous answer of yes, that there are going to be those that are offended. You know, how dare they? I mean, this is our land. This is our country. And this is something we've talked about so many times. Going back once again to only 80% came out of Babylon, or excuse me, 20% came out of Babylon, 80% stayed behind. If rabbinic sources are true, then 80% stayed back in Egypt, continued to assimilate, you know, as best they could. I don't think they ever would have assimilated. Most of them probably died. But, you know, there's a group of people that's heading out of Egypt here that are looking back to Egypt. They continue to look back because their inward man is drawn to the things of the past. They're offended. Let's look at it this way. Maybe they're not offended at Egypt, but they're offended at Moshe. They're offended at Yah himself. How dare Moshe come in and orchestrate all this by this God that he's talking about to make us leave our house, to make us leave our home. We were doing just fine. We were doing fine. There was nothing wrong. I mean, we were just having to work a little bit harder than we used to, but we're fine. And then all of a sudden, the Pharaoh is telling them they must go, but are they really going? Are they going kind of like Lot's wife did, looking back at every curve in the road, looking back, and their hearts never, you know, I've been teaching a lot on the words of the psalmist. He says, when Yah turned to the turning, it says when he restored the fortunes to Zion, in most translations. But the word there is, when he turned to the turning, we were as those who dream.
Mm-hmm.
How many of the Hebrews coming out of Egypt were dreamers? Very few. Very few.
Mike, I don't know that they had the capacity to dream.
No, because slaves have lost the capacity to dream. This is why one of the Torah portions, first Torah portions of Numbers, of Midbar is not so. Lift your heads. I look to the hills from where comes my, from whence cometh, I'll do a little King James. I look to the hills from whence cometh my salvation. It's about lifting your head. When you see these things begin to happen, lift your heads, because your redemption is drawing near. That's a posture. That's a posture of going from slaves looking down at the ground because they have no hope, to looking up. A slave never looks up, and a free man never looks down.
So
That was good to comment. I like that one. I like the way that.
Well, it inspired me with a comment here.
Okay,
so,
go for it.
Well, don't steal it, because I got it. I've already written it down as a part of this teaching.
You may remember I said that. Okay.
Okay. So when you lift your head, I when you said that, I was thinking of Abraham, who was told, "Lift your eyes."
Yeah.
Look out to the east, the west, the north, the south, and all the land that you see, I will give to you. Yeah, now Yah already had that vision. To him, he's already looking in the future, and he's seeing the reality of when the descendants of Abraham are going to come and possess all of that land. And when he is telling Abraham that, it's a done deal. It is fact. It's not a maybe so or on these conditions. He emphatically said, this is what's going to happen. But in order for you, Abraham, you've got to lift your eyes. In other words, you've got to lift up your vision. You're seeing too close to the ground. You need to look in a larger, bigger, more spiritual scope. When he and Yitzhak were approaching Mount Moriah, he lifted his eyes and he looked and he saw things in the future tense. So it is necessary for you and I to, you know, it's not just so much physically raise your head and look at the sky. You'll elevate your vision. Mm-hmm. When you've looked at things on a certain level and scale, there are times that Yah says, look above that scale. Well, you know, that's not my place. It's important that everybody just know their place and stay in it. No, no. When you have finished your work in one place, Yah needs to elevate you to another. So Israel had only seen themselves in the confines of the borders of Mitzrayim and not in the whole of the country, but they knew their place down in Goshen. Mm-hmm. And they knew that their labor was the labor for Pharaoh to build his cities and monuments. They knew what their role was. They knew their station in life, and so much so that when Pharaoh says, throw your male children to the god of the Nile, they obeyed. Yeah. I mean, what kind of mindset is that? And Moshe comes in and starts talking about an elevated vision that he got at a burning bush. I see you as a free people. I see you living again in the land. I see you without chains and shackles and without scars and whips on your back. And I see your children not as slaves, but as possessors of the kingdom's covenant fulfillment. And we have to elevate our vision to that level, or we will never change our circumstance. Mm-hmm. It's called being a visionary. You have to become a visionary where you see what Yah is looking at. Otherwise, you'll never get out of where you're at.
Yeah, and you know, it goes to that verse that's been misquoted so many times, without vision, the people perish. But most people will never read the rest of the verse that says, how happy are those who keep the Torah. The Torah is about giving us a vision of going back home. The Torah begins with Adam and Eve in a garden called home and being pushed into exile. And the Torah is about redeeming us back to that place. The rest of the scripture is commentary on what the Torah is promising us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so you're talking about Abraham and how he got a vision. That vision continued on because it says in Hebrews that he looked for a city whose builder and maker was Elohim. He was looking for the manifestation of a city he had already seen. Think about that. He was looking for a manifestation of a city he had already seen.
Hmm.
When we understand that the vision, that, and I guess here comes the problem, is that a slave is incapable of a vision. Only a free man is capable of a vision. Now, I believe that a slave can, and I'm not talking about the slavery that America went through, you know, years ago. Let's get that section. You know, when we mention these words, it brings in connotations of what happened in the United States. That was tragic, yes. But slavery is something that is a part of our country today. It's a part of Europe today. It is a part of every country in the world today. Because slavery is keeping people in bondage to a system. Very few people, while in bondage to that system, will ever get a vision of coming out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
You know, you look at people and to bring back in, I guess, to bring back in something that was part of the American, the United States history, Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks. Whether you know, and these people have been in a way deified. They were still humans. They still had mistakes. They still were human beings that had their problems. But let me tell you what they did. What they had. They had a dream in the midst of something. They saw past it.
Yes.
And the moment that they saw past it, they were no longer a slave. They were a free man waiting for the manifestation of their freedom.
Wow. So these Hebrews living in Mitzrayim or Egypt, they are feeling ethnically condemned and ridiculed and unfairly treated because of our ethnicity. The only reason that Pharaoh is doing this is because of our lineage and bloodline. That was on the surface. Yah's vision says, no, I'm doing this. I'm working behind Pharaoh. He thinks he's following his own decree here. No, I am the Elohim of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, and I remember the covenant that I made with them. Mm-hmm. You're not leaving because you're being ethnically purged from a country. No, it's the covenant of Abraham that is at work and moving you and changing your destiny. So, you know, in our day, I cannot imagine in this country someone saying, if you claim to be Hebrew, you're no longer welcome. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Yeshua said in Matthew 10:22, and you shall be hated by all. One translation said, hated by everyone for my name's sake. But he who shall have endured to the end shall be saved. It's not our Hebrewness, if you will. It's not our Hebraic focused teaching. It's not our Shabbat keeping. Those things are vital and incredibly important. Mike, it is our Messiah likeness. Mm-hmm. It is our affinity and identity with Yeshua that is going to open up the gates and cause us to leave.
Well, you know, in that all people, you know, people will hate you because of my namesake. Let me just kind of cut to the chase. That if everybody likes you, you're not accomplishing anything. And if your desire is to have everybody like you, you'll never accomplish anything. In order to accomplish something great, you have to be willing to be not liked by everybody. Bill Gates was not liked by everyone, especially IBM. Steve Jobs was not liked by everyone, especially Bill Gates. to do something great, you've got to be willing to go out there. I just put out a thought for the day a couple days ago that I had somebody say, you got to explain that one. And it was, any dead fish can swim downstream. That's right. Any dead fish can swim downstream. But when you start swimming upstream, expect you're going to have challenges. And those challenges may be from not just from grizzly bears and fishermen, but maybe from the fish next to you that's trying to keep you back, trying to hold you back. See, this whole thing, Barry, that life is easy, that it's the cakewalk, you know, tiptoeing through the tulips, whatever. It says that he did not guide them on the highway that goes through the land of the Philistines that was close by. But he took them on a roundabout route. He did not take them on what they thought was the easy way. They thought the easy way would be to go through the land of the Philistines because it was the shortest route. The shortest and easiest route in their minds would have killed them faster. The roundabout route was the most difficult, but it was also what they needed. They needed to go through the trials. Every one of us needs to go through the trials of life. And in the midst of them, we need to embrace those trials as being for our own good. He leads me through the valley of the shadow of darkness for his namesake. I mean, put that verse together. He leads us through what to us looks like the shadow of death. I'm about to die here. I'm not going to make it. I'll never make it. I'll never get through this. But the verse goes on to say, not for us, but for his namesake. He's leading them through this roundabout route in order to make them into a people that will prove his name great.
So don't be surprised at the roundabout route. Why is this taking so long? I can't understand. It would have made a whole lot more sense to me if he had done it another way. Yeah, he's sparing you. He's causing you to live and not die before you even get halfway there.
Well, Barry, consider it like this. If you have a God that's asking your opinion, you need to change gods.
Well, that might be exactly the case there.
I really don't want to serve a God that's asking my opinion about anything.
Well, it's not to say that he hadn't asked me a few questions on occasion, but it wasn't because he was looking for information he didn't have.
Yeah, it was because he was looking for my response. He's never, the old adage, has it ever occurred to you that nothing's ever occurred to him?
Occurred to him, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And my opinion of what is going to be and the way that I need to go and all of those things. And then it comes to this place. Now, they're to come out of this place. Let me back up, because they come out and it's the people. They're going up from the land. They're fully armed, it says. That's David Stern's translation. So they have everything that they need for the journey. They have the gold. They have the silver. They have the tapestries. They have all the stuff that they need. They have the latest armaments, they have the wagons, they have the sheep, the goats, they have all the stuff that they need, but they're to come out in divisions. Are they not?
Military formation is what that means. Marching formation. It wasn't like it was in the Ten Commandments where they were just, hodgepodge, meandering out. No, they walked out in rank and file. Organized. Can you imagine that? The Hebrew roots people organized and marching together. How did that happen? So some of us have got to lift our vision higher than the current squabble, fussy, instigating argument, debate stuff that's going on. And see a people unified, functioning together as a single unit and willing to march, and began to call that vision into existence. Stop. And Mike, at some point we got to stop chiding and reproving and rebuking and start commanding. This is the way it's going to be. Now get in line and take on your role and be a servant. You think?
Yeah. Yeah. How we get there, that's going to be the interesting one. And we'll have a whole break here of, music and commercials where we can talk about it and we can figure out the answers. We'll be right back.
me cry. Stand up on mighty Priam and say you rise.
Well, here we go again. Foundations for Life with Barry Phillips, myself, Mike Clayton. And that break, Barry, was not long enough for us to figure out the answer to the question of how do we get everybody in order. So I think we'll just, let's just do something crazy. Let's let the Father take care of that one, and let's move on.
Well, let me just share this.
Okay.
Just share this. In the book of Acts chapter 2 and verse 1, when the Ruach was poured out, it was upon a people that were in one mind, in one location.
In one Honda.
They had one accord. And again, there was an issue that rose about Hellenistic widows being neglected, and evidently in a daily administration of food. And the issue was handed over, and they agreed that it seemed good to the Ruach HaKodesh and to us. And it was handled. It wasn't fighting. It wasn't debating. They had an issue. They handled it. Mm-hmm. And the Ruach gave the approval over it. So that's the way it's supposed to be. That's just the way it needs to be.
Yeah, but you had something interesting in that day. You had leadership of one mind. Until leadership is working together, and I'm not going to go real far with this one, but until you have leaders that are willing to work together, you can't have the decision of what to do. There's the key.
Agreed.
Yeah, there's a key. I mean, look at what's happening in Washington, D.C. right now. That fiasco is going on. If when you have leaders, and this is as simple as it is of what's going on in Washington, D.C., you have so-called leaders that are out for their own agenda, their own power, their own pocket. What's it going to take for that to come down? I don't know. So let's move on to something with us individually, because we can sit there and deal with that one for a long time. So they come out of Egypt. Everything is just great. I mean, they're flying high. Yeah, they're high-fiving each other. Hey, did you see what? I mean, remember that plague? Wow, that one was, where were you when the lights went out? You know, that kind of thing. That could be a song, the lights, the night the lights went out in Egypt or something. Maybe you could do that. But, yeah, that was a really bad one.
I know.
So, I mean, they're celebrating, okay, until they come up to a Dead Sea, or to a Sea of Suf, the Red Sea, the Reed Sea. It's amazing to me that people can't even agree on the name of what the sea was. Does it really matter?
It was a body of water.
When you're standing there and you have mountains on your left, mountains on your right, and a ticked off Pharaoh with a bunch of soldiers in the back, can you imagine them going, is this the Reed Sea or the Red Sea? Well, in Paleo Hebrew, it means that we're stuck here and about to die. Yeah. I mean, the silliness, the silliness that just comes out once in a while, just driving me crazy. You don't even have to start the car most of the times. So here they are standing there, and their progress is stopped. So what's the natural reaction? Let's complain.
Panic.
Complain. God's not with us. So he takes us through a period of success. And then brings us to a place of a dead end. Now what are you going to do? Well, obviously, God's not in this. Obviously, we made a mistake. Obviously, we made a wrong turn. Oh, I didn't hear him. All these things. Instead, it is his plan to bring us to a place that appears to be a dead end, in order to show himself mighty at a higher level than we have seen before.
Well, I can't imagine that Yah has gone to all of the detail of all the actions that he has done thus far. Giving the covenant to calling Abraham out of Ur, giving him the covenant, detailing to him how that his future generations will be enslaved, and he'll bring him out with a mighty arm, raising up Moshe, calling him in the desert, all the plagues, all the struggles with Pharaoh, teaching the people to come out in formation, only to put them on a beachhead and let them die. You know, Yah has done too much in our lives already for it to be a wash and a nothing burger. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
Did you say nothing burger on air?
I did. I've watched somebody said something about that the other day. And by comparison, Yeshua has been born of a virgin, lived among us, given us the keys to the kingdom, taught us the Torah and its truth, died, resurrected, ascended, and promised to come again. And he's done all of that so you and I could fail, so that we could just wash out, that we would have an obstacle that is beyond achieving or a breakthrough over. I don't buy it.
Okay, Barry, I got that. I got it. As long as we put the word we in there, then it's okay. Or if I transpose that and say that the Almighty is trusted, is invested so much in Barry Phillips that I have seen the investment, and there's no way that I can ever consider the possibility that he has brought you to this place, invested so much in you, that you would fail. I'm going to put you on the spot. Does that statement make you uncomfortable? When you look in your mirror, in those times that you're alone with just you?
Earlier this year, yes, it would have made me uncomfortable. Now, much, much less so. And it's not arrogance. It's not pride.
Okay.
It is accomplishment.
Much less so. Okay, and I know you well enough. You're going to be honest in statements. Much less so. Which means you still look in that mirror once in a while. See, I can make that statement without any doubt in my mind concerning you. But I still have to look in my own mirror.
Yes.
In those times of doubt, it is, you know, is this the last stand at the last Reed Sea? The mountains are closing in. The things are, you know, I got things coming on my back here. Is this going to be my... This may shock some people. It's you know, having confidence sometimes. Sometimes you just wing it and act it. Okay. Each one of us, if we're honest, goes through those moments, the same as the Hebrews did standing on the Reed Sea.
There, but others would look at you and say, you know, Mike always gets his prayers answered. Mike always comes through on top. Mike always achieves. Mike's always got, you know, the accomplishment. But I know you well enough to know that behind every achievement and every breakthrough, that there's been a struggle and a wrestling. And, you know, after it's broke through, it's a wondering, how did that happen? And you sit back amazed and shake your head. I know you well enough. I spent enough time with you to know that's the way it is. That's the way it is for all of us.
Yeah.
Nobody gets all of their prayers answered the first time they pray them. I don't know anybody like that.
Oh, I had somebody, and they were kidding a little bit the other day, but they said, you know, I wasn't going to call you because, you know, I felt God told me something to tell you, but I said, but God, he's Mike Clayton. I mean, he hears from you all the time. And it's like, quiet. No. I need that too. We all do. But we need to be honest with each other and once in a while say, you know, I understand what these Hebrews go through. We all struggle with this. And to say that we don't, Barry, there's no other way to call it than a lie.
There's no other thing to call it. I mean, Yah allows all of us a challenge to perfect us, to mature us, to stretch us, to cause us to get out of our comfort zones. Everybody. So whoever's sitting out there thinking, yeah, but it's double for me. No, it's not. No, it's not. Every last one of us have had those times where we thought we had been wrung completely out.
I mean, all of us. Yeah, look at the one that's getting the greatest challenge here. Moshe himself. The guy with the staff in his hand. You know, what are we supposed to do now? Okay, he's looking around a little bit. People are breathing down his neck. I mean, he doesn't get a lot of grace in this one.
No.
The Almighty looks at him and says, why are you looking at me, man? What are you doing, Moshe, why are you praying? What's in your hand? Move forward. There's a time to quit praying and take action.
Yep.
This idea, and you hit it with your reconnect. We've talked about this. Hanok's talked about this a lot. This really impacted a mutual friend of ours, Joey Moen, who we'll be working together with in Lake City at Kol HaMashiach in the month of February. Just an unashamed plug there.
Yes.
The difference in the Jewish concepts and the Christian concepts of, you know, everything is about, you know, pray and God will do it. Then we get to Messianic. Pray and Yah will do it. On the Jewish side of the fence, it's pray while you're doing something. You know? Get busy.
Yes.
Get busy. Do something. There's a time that we put prayer and action into the same word. Prayer and action should not be two separate things. It's like faith and works. Traditions of man have tried so hard to take faith and works and put them into two different categories, when in fact they are so intricately linked that you cannot separate them.
One of the first things, I think even you may have taught us this, Mike, many, many years ago, getting started, is that the Hebraic mind concept of things is you don't wait until you understand a command. You just do the command, and the understanding will come as you do. It's very similar in prayer.
Yeah. It's a concept out of Devarim. Yeah.
You don't wait until the answer comes before you are ready to act. You're already to act and are already acting out according to your prayers, and the answer will come.
Well, this is this is actually a song that you did.
Yes.
We will do.
And we will hear.
And we will hear. In the doing, we will hear. You remember when you were learning how to drive? I mean, I know this is ancient history here.
I do.
Yeah. But when you're learning to drive, you get sat in the driver's seat. You got the steering wheel in front of you. There's a gas pedal and a brake and the engine's on, and they're telling you everything you got to do. At some point, you got to put your foot on the gas to learn how to do it.
Yeah, it's no more sitting in the driveway turning that steering wheel back and forth and making motor noises with your mouth. Yeah.
Especially in the days of no power steering.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how we got bicep muscles in that day, where it was a little, you know, no power steering. But at some point, you got to put that thing in gear. You got to put your foot on the gas and start moving forward in order to learn how to drive. I will do and I will hear. Through my doing, it's a statement that comes into Judaism. Through doing comes understanding. Through putting your foot in the water when there's nowhere to go comes understanding. It's the same rod. Interesting enough, it's the same staff, I believe, that Moshe had thrown down at the burning bush. And that staff is now what is leading them across another miracle. Some point, you just got to go. What's the worst that can happen?
Yeah, well, the worst that could happen is to them at this point, Mike, something happened here. Back up a little bit in verse 5, it says it was reported to the sovereign of Mitzrayim that the people had fled. Well, he told them to get out. They didn't flee. He threw them out. But somebody put spin on that. And it affected his mind. Of course, you know, our society is ruled by the spin of the media. And everybody, you know, anyone that's got a chance to stand in front of a camera or audio recording, they are putting spin on the world events. But there's a key. In 2 Corinthians chapter 2, it talks about the fact that in verse 12, we've not received the spirit of the world, but the spirit that is from Elohim, in order to know what Elohim has favorably given us. So, you know, he continues on, which we also speak not in words which man wisdom teaches, but the set apart spirit teaches. So the natural man is not going to hear the rule, but the spiritual man is. You know, Pharaoh could not have discerned what Yah was up to. He was a natural man. Moshe knew because he's a man who learned to walk by the spirit, not the flesh. So this, if we're going to inundate ourselves with, you know, the spin cycles and the talking heads, we're going to relegate ourselves to the masses who are led by their flesh and their natural inclinations. There has to be a remnant of people who can discern the voice of Elohim, hear from the Ruach, and know when it's time to move, and know to stick your hand with a rod in it out over the water and let him move the water out of your way. That's not easily discerned. Thankfully, Moshe had the ability to discern Yah's voice in the middle of all those hollering, screaming people. What a distraction. Can you imagine millions of people panicked and screaming, and in the middle of all of that, Moshe's hearing Yah's voice?
Yeah. Yeah, they're panicked and screaming at him, by the way.
Yes. So you have to learn to quieten down your spirit on the inside. It's almost like retreating inside the shell of who you are to where the noise factories around you are no longer drowning his voice out. Because the noise around you is never going to stop. If I could just find a good quiet place to pray, good luck in that. It's rare. Because even when you get there, your own mind will be so loud that it'd be hard to hear anything.
Oh, one of the hardest, one of the noisiest places to pray is a place that is quiet.
Yeah.
Because that voice inside your own head is the one that drowns out everything else. Learning how to quiet that voice. When you learn how to, when we learn how to quiet the voice inside of us, then it makes no difference what the crowd noise is around us.
You'll start hearing things that people are saying, and it sounds all religious and good, and your spirit man on the inside will be saying, "That ain't me. That's not him. That's not what Yah is saying." You know, it sounds reasonable and preachy, but it's not what he's saying.
So Moshe gets this word, and I've got one of the paintings from Udi Marotz is right in front of me of Moshe standing there and the people going through. I love that painting. The some of the writings state that he actually started walking out in the water. And it wasn't until he got up to about his nose level that the waters actually split. Now, whether that's true or not, I really don't know because I haven't seen the actual movie. But it wouldn't surprise me in the least bit. Because that's the way that the Father normally works. That in order to do something in life, you got to get your feet wet.
Mm-hmm.
Those that are on dry ground, that never put forth with any ambition, the ability, the desire to walk forward, never take a risk, never take a chance. I'm just going to stand here on the riverbank because I know that on the riverbank I can't drown. I might be stabbed in the back by an Egyptian. but I can't drown, so I'm just going to stand here because the inevitable is that I'm going to get stabbed in the back. I'd rather drown trying to go forward than be stabbed in the back by an Egyptian.
Well, Mike, if Moshe had been an American, he would have had all the women and children get between next to the edge of the water, while he and the men would have formed a battle formation at the narrow entrance between the two mountains, mm-hmm. and pulled a Spartan stand such as at Thermopylae, and tried to defend and believe the Father to give him military victory. That's not what Yah had in mind.
Yeah, and if he'd have been a Muslim, he'd have put the women and children behind the men.
Or in front of the men.
He'd have put them between. He'd have been, he said, okay, women and children back at the, in the back there, so they got to get to you before they get to us, because Islamic Muslims are cowards.
Well, just tell us how you feel about it, though.
I will. You send your children out in the midst of an uprising, you put your children on the front line of an uprising, you're a coward. There's no way around that.
Send your cards and letters to Mike Clayton.
That's right. You see a riot going on outside your house, you send your child out there, you're a coward.
Yep. I agree. Mm-hmm. So Yah had a plan.
Send cards to Barry, too.
Pharaoh was not going, his army was not going to die by the sword, but by the hand of Yah. You know, drowning in a chariot is not necessarily a part of anybody's battle scheme. But Yah had a plan. A warrior wants to die a warrior's death. That was not a warrior's death. For a warrior to die in a giant bathtub, that's pretty unseemly for a warrior. So y'all got some gloating there, some glory out of that.
And that is the purpose of the whole thing. To receive glory.
to watch me cry. Stand up on mighty Ephraim and say you rise.
Welcome back to Foundations for Life with Mike Clayton and Barry Phillips. We're glad to have you along. And Mike, let's do a bold thing and actually venture into chapter 15. Unless you got something in 14 you want to still bring out.
I'm good.
So this is not the song of Moshe. That takes place in the book of Devarim. But this is a song that Israel sang once Pharaoh and his army were destroyed. But there's something unique here. It says that Moshe and the children of Israel sang the song, but the verb they're saying is in the imperfect tense, meaning that the action is not complete. That is, they sang and it's either still being sung or still yet to be sung. So I looked this up yesterday, and in Strong's Concordance online, it was talking about the imperfect tense is used to express the future, referring not only to an action which is about to be accomplished, but the one that has not begun yet. So in other words, by all that, then it agrees with the rabbinic position that this song was not only sang here but will be sung again in the resurrection. Well, what are they singing about? How that Yah overthrew the adversary in a very dramatic form and fashion, and delivered his people, that those that had been oppressing Israel were finally destroyed. What are we told about in the book of Revelation, but about how that Yeshua is going to return and vanquish the foes of Israel and destroy them? We're going to sing this song again, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Revelation 15, it says in the first four verses that we're going to sing the song of Moshe and the song of the Lamb. So there's going to be a lot of singing going on. I don't know about you, but when I think about people singing and rejoicing, I don't think about them being in a funeral dirge necessarily. But it sounds like we're going to have some celebrating to do.
Yeah.
No Hallelujah. Problem.
Yeah.
The future's not dull and constricted. And it's not governed by our Congress or politicians or Hollywood or Wall Street or anybody else. It's determined by Yah. The Nephilim are not going to wipe man out. We're not going to fall off a flat earth. This thing's going to work.
Yeah, no cat's going to push you off.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, the verse, I was thinking about this verse this morning, I think early. The kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of Elohim.
Yes.
As powerful as these people around us today think they are, you know, to see the I guess we should start calling Dumb and Dumber, Pelosi and or Schumer or whoever that is. Is it Schumer?
Yes.
Yeah. These aren't smart people. I mean, they're just not. And what they're trying to do with this whole thing with Trump, these people would stand in front of Elohim himself and try to do the same thing.
Same spirit.
The same exact spirit. That all of these people have. I mean, the craziest set of verses to me in all of Scripture is when the end of the millennium, when Hasatan and the demonic forces are unleashed, that there will be a group of natural people that turn after seeing 1,000 years of a perfect kingdom, they will turn and fight against that one who gave them that perfect life.
That's how strong the delusion will be in that day.
Yeah. Exactly. So what man is capable of is laid out to us here in these verses, in that a people who are delivered, writing state it took about a year for that for the plagues to go through and for this deliverance to happen. They're brought to the edge of a sea. The sea splits. They're taken through on dry ground. Their enemies are drowned behind them. And they complain about water?
Well, they got to complain about something.
Is that... Did you just say something more than you thought, Barry? People, for the most part, have to find something to complain about.
Yeah.
The verses in, I think it's Isaiah, about Isaiah 12 or so, that talks about that I will put an end to those that complain.
You know, Mike, a pastor that I was on staff for, he didn't teach me much, but he did teach me one thing. And that is that when someone comes into your office and they're bitterly complaining and upset and just spewing on you, chances are the whole issue that they're upset and spewing about is not what they're really upset about.
Oh, yeah.
And if you'll be patient, you'll finally figure out they're upset about B, not A. It's something else. And you are a convenient target that they're taking their frustrations out on for something unrelated to their core issue. Mm-hmm. The core issue for Israel was that is suggested in the word where we get Mara from Marar. They were bitter and they were grieved and they were irritated and exasperated. I think that all of the angst as to the life that they had lived. Oh yeah, Yah is delivering us now, but if he's delivering us now, why couldn't he have delivered us when my relatives and my parents were dying mm-hmm. in Mitzrayim? What took so long? Why did he wait until all of these good and decent people were buried in the Egyptian dust? Mm-hmm. Before he decided to send Moshe down. Moshe, where have you been? Why weren't you there 40 years earlier? And they were irritated. You know, people, believe it or not, people get mad at Yahweh. And believe it or not, I've been mad at him. I think if we all were honest that there were times that we were just plain irritated and angry at the way he chose to do something. But, you know, after a year, I spent a year angry at him. Still prayed, still taught, still worshiped, still did a lot of things. But underneath the surface, I was angry because of the way he allowed some things to happen. And I told him as much. I'm angry at you. Do you know what? He didn't get angry back. He didn't judge me. He didn't knock me down. He didn't strike me with lightning. He didn't crucify me. He didn't allow people to abuse me. And he let me deal with my anger until I got to a place that he and I could talk about it. And I'm not angry anymore. We have to be a people that is willing to deal with our stuff. Or else the water is always going to taste bitter to us.
Mm-hmm. Because he took them to those bitter waters because they needed to go to the bitter waters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there was a different way, I think that he would have taken them there. But the truth is, they needed to go there. They had all of this stuff in them. Let's call it the toxins of Egypt. And before they could be healed, they first had to be cleansed. they first had to do a detox.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. If you don't do a detox from the toxins, you can put everything you want into, and let's talk about physical body. You can put everything perfect into your body, but until you cleanse the detox, the toxins out, the good stuff cannot take over. And the reaction, many times the reaction to the detox can be a bit on the
unpleasant side.
There you go. That's a good word. Unpleasant side. Cleaning out something is not pleasant. I remember in Oklahoma having my septic tank cleaned. Now, why anyone in the world would grow up wanting to do that for a living? Even for the amount of money I think the guy was making. The guy was making a lot of money, but there's just not that much money in the world, I don't think, to have me do something like that voluntarily. But in order for that septic to continue to work, it had to be cleaned. In order for the work that needed to be done in the Hebrews to be done, they had to go to Mara. But there was a work that was done physically, because it says, I mean, they were throwing up there. There was some stuff coming out of their physical body. But was it that they weren't seeing that which was happening in the physical was also supposed to be happening in the spiritual?
Well, the spiritual side of that is, as we find out later on in the Torah, the Sota, is the bride that has been is suspicious of being immoral,
mm-hmm.
and acting in a improper way against her husband. The bitter waters is a test.
Mm-hmm.
So for those that had never really put idolatry out of their heart, and those that had lived shamefully in Mitzrayim, found themselves judged at the bitter waters. So Yah allows the bitter tasting things to prove our heart to us.
Mm-hmm.
However, Moshe's instructed to put a tree in there. A tree is a tzaddik. Yeshua is the tzaddik that makes the bitter waters sweet, that brings healing to us. So the key in our bitterness is to find Yeshua. Where are you at in this? Where do I see you, and where am I missing you?
Hmm.
Not easily done when you're upset, which means you got to get over being upset before you can start catching vision.
Yeah, and that's probably what keeps a lot of people from getting the vision of the Tzaddik, the tree, the righteous branch that is being thrown in the midst of the bitterness to turn it sweet. Until a person comes to the end of at least desiring to get rid of the bitterness, until they, as we used to say years ago in a something I was involved in, until you become so sick and tired of being sick and tired, you'll probably just remain sick and tired.
True.
It's the willingness. He'll bring you to the place of dealing with yourself. But then there is an action. And again, coming back to this, Barry, I think this is the one of the difficulties of trying to get over some things still, you know, coming to this lifestyle of a Torah and, you know, celebrating this and celebrating that. The other thing, those are still the externals. The internals are the ones that are, you still have to deal with, still have to figure out, still have to get through. And probably one of the largest ones, one of the major ones is, going back to where we were at in one of the other segments, if I just pray, God will do everything. You know, he brought them to the bitter waters, but they had to stand there and start drinking.
Yeah.
To go forward a little bit. When they're complaining about their, you know, I'm dying of starvation. No, you're not. You don't start dying of starvation until day 40. They're not at day 40 yet. They're hungry. Yes. You ever had one of your children when you're, you know, when you're raising your children, they say, I'm starving to death. No, you're not. You had breakfast. You're not starving to death. You may feel a little bit of hunger pains, because that's something that Americans don't do. Hunger pains. Well, no, I'm starving to death. No, you're not. So he brings them there to this place. They begin to complain. What does he do? He gives them manna. But they had to go out and get the manna. Again, it's an action. They could have starved to death with manna all around the camp. Well, let's just pray that it comes into my mouth tomorrow morning. That's how many people want it. I run into people, Barry, that are too lazy. This sounds judgmental, but it's just the facts. They're too lazy to walk out of their tent to pick up their own manna. All right, we were in Florida years ago. When we first moved to Florida, we had blueberry bushes out in front of our house. I mean, we had this whole line of them. It was over 100 blueberry bushes, and they were huge, and they produced. And I would tell people, there was no way we could eat that many blueberries. I'd tell people, why don't you come by the house and get some blueberries? I mean, the bushes are full. Could you bring me some?
No, come get them.
What do you want me to do? What do you want me to do? Put them in your mouth too? You know, do I look like one of the women standing there with a fan over the Pharaoh putting grapes in their mouth? No. People are too lazy. They're too lazy to come to your house to pick free blueberries. They'd rather go to the store and buy them for $5 a quart. So you offer somebody something, they're too lazy to walk out the door to get it. It's crazy. So what do you do?
Okay, so you take such a person into a setting like the wilderness where they get proved. Yep. You know, my mom used to say, you know, when I turned up my nose at what she made for supper. Well, I guess if you get hungry, you'll eat it.
Mm-hmm. Or you'll figure out how to make something there, you like.
You know, I'd sit there and stare at the plate, but I don't want that. Well, again, son, that's what we got tonight. And if you're going to eat, that's what you're eating. No, you can't go make a sandwich. This is supper. And you're going to eat what's put in front of you, or you can do without. Well, I sit there for a while, and then my belly start growling a little louder, and I finally realize, pass me the salt. Maybe I can kill the taste.
Must have been a lot of beans.
You learn to eat some things that at first glance you might not like. But you put people in a place where their pickiness is gone. You know, a pastor told me years ago that at the end of a service that two men walked in and told him that they were traveling and that they were hungry. Could this beautiful church people help them out with some food? The pastor said, absolutely. We got a kitchen in the back down here. We got bread. We've got lunch meats. We got food for you to eat. And the man said, oh, no, just call down to the Shoney's and tell them that you'll pay for it and we can eat there. And he said, no, I'm not going to pay for food at Shoney's when we got food here in the church.
Mm-hmm.
You're free to go back and make all the sandwiches and stuff that you want. They left for about 5-10 minutes. And then they came back and said, can we still get a sandwich? The wilderness is called a hungry place. Mm-hmm. It's called a thirsty place. Mm-hmm. It's a dry, barren place. There are no Walmarts to shop at. They had a pile of money in their money bags, but there was nowhere to buy anything.
Well, the wilderness is a place that you begin to listen. You know, it's we of course go to the next Torah portion, and we're almost out of time. We go to the next Torah portion, and we see the 10 words that are given. But the words begin to be given in this Torah portion. It says in, where is it here, at the end of verse 15, that he began to give them, that Yah made laws and rules of life for them, and there he tested them and said, if you will listen intently to his voice, and it goes on from there, that he won't give you any of the diseases he brought on the Egyptians. And we can go back to this when we come back, but it's in the wilderness that you come to the end of yourself. The moment that you come to the end of yourself is a wonderful place to stand.
You know, the rabbis teach concerning this, Mike, what you're just saying there, that a change takes place by one of two means. Either a traumatic experience, which has to facilitate a sudden change, like the wilderness,
mm-hmm.
or B, a change of daily routine, which will affect your instinctive behavior. And in the wilderness, Yah gave him a good dose of trauma and a good dose of change of daily routine. Mm-hmm. Because when the cloud moved, they better be ready to move. When it stayed, they had to stay. So their daily routine was not dictated by the taskmasters of Egypt any longer. But Yah was leading them by his spirit and by his revelation, which they had to remain discerning about.
Well, that'd be a pretty good one to come back to maybe on the other segment, the last segment tonight, is that what happens when you go from a life of slavery and every moment is dictated to a life of freedom, where it is self-discipline. How many people could take that change?
It's like winning the lottery without discipline. You're a fool of his money or soon going to be parted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because if you don't have discipline, you know, it's a statement that we do not have today. It is not that he is withholding prayers, but normally we have exactly what we can manage. If you want more in life, you need to learn how to manage what you have. Without management, growth will cease. A company that cannot manage will not grow. You will only grow as far as your management. And that's a life principle. And in the wilderness, they had to learn, or at least they were being asked to learn how to manage their own lives. Only two made it in the end.
Mm.
All right.
Well, we'll talk about that on the other side, because we got music coming up.
There you go. Hey, Barry.
Hey.
Welcome back to Foundations for Life. We were just having a little conversation about something, folks, and we were talking about the this concept. I mean, this is we were actually talking about the Torah portion here as Perry came back. that you're listening to Foundations for Life, and you got a little bit extra of what goes on in the background times. So here's what the Hebrews are doing, and I was relating this to something that with Barry here as we were coming off the break, that the Hebrews are looking for something free, are they not?
Yeah.
But is anything in life free, Barry?
Not really. It's kind of like I finally figured out, Mike. The you get a interest-free loan on an automobile. You go buy a brand new automobile. They say we will give you 0% financing for even 6 years. Wow. Then they're just taking installment payments on the price of the vehicle. No, it's included. The finance charge is included up front in the price of the vehicle.
Yeah, you know when that began? I was actually selling cars when that began. Rebates. This was back in the 80s. Buy a car, we're going to give you $500 free. You had to buy a $10,000 car to get $500. Okay, let's take this to the place we're trying to get to. Is any of this free to the Hebrews? Is the manna? They're getting manna from the heavens free. Or are they? The manna is coming because of obedience. They're being obedient, and obedience is bringing forth blessing. See where I'm going with that?
Mm-hmm.
That they, you know, we've got to get out of this mindset that, and this is, I was talking about something on Amazon and this place and eBay. You know, how many times do you go on eBay and you will buy something that is free shipping? You'll look at it as free shipping. In fact, there's even a place you can click there, free shipping. Something else can be less money, but they're charging shipping, which is more honest in the end. But people want something free. The scripture, the blessings of the scripture come to us when we are obedient to what his word says. This is where we have to figure this out. Is that there is something for us to do. There is a responsibility for us to walk in.
Yes.
That it's not just going to come down from the heavens just because we're so wonderful. In order for that manna to continue to come, they needed to learn how to walk in obedience. If they went out and got tried to get it on the seventh day, what happened? They weren't going to eat that day. If they didn't get enough on the sixth day, if they said, oh, I don't need to get the double, I'll just get what I had yesterday.
That would be a skinny Shabbat.
It's going to be a skinny Shabbat. Yeah, it's going to be a little rationing there on Shabbat. So here we have the Hebrews that are being taught in the wilderness something called taking responsibility. So to go back to what we were talking about prior to the break when we hit that little time there, is they had gone from slavery.
Yes.
And where every action, that they did not have to think. A slave, you get up in the morning when somebody tells you to get up. Let me give you an idea of if you're a slave today or not. If you have an alarm clock that wakes you up every morning and tells you when you have to be at a certain place, you are a servant to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you may have an alarm clock, but is that alarm clock set to the time that is going to be give you just enough time to get to work, or is that alarm clock set to a time that I can wake up and spend some time with my Creator, with His Word, with improving my own self before somebody tells me I have to be somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is called slavery. The other one is called self-discipline. I would suggest to anyone that self-discipline has the ability to work a person out of slavery. Slavery will never bring a person to self-discipline. The Hebrews had to learn in the wilderness self-discipline. And one of those disciplines was this: not complaining.
Oh, man. Oh, man. You know, Mike, it is so easy. So easy to find yourself in a negative train of thought and start up it in your mouth. And, you know, I know people that every once in a while I have to look at them and say, the next thing is positive. I'd love to hear it. You know, after a while, it just dawns on you. The mumbling, grumbling, and complaining thing has been going on for a while.
Mm-hmm.
We don't set out to intentionally grumble and complain. It's just we start voicing our attitude. And sometimes we fail to understand our attitude stinks. We got too much to be thankful for in this country.
Oh.
There is very few. I mean, yes, there are some people who have some very dire situations, even in a nation like ours. But for the vast majority of us, with a roof over our head and food in our stomach and a decent place to sleep, something that we can count on, we go basically where we want to go. We do basically what we want to do. We have, even if we find ourselves in a mountain of debt and it's coming crashing down on us, there are still opportunities. If you're willing to put your hand to the plow and push, you can get yourself out of the ditch that you fell in, mm-hmm, financially, spiritually. There are people here that will help you. There are opportunities available for you to find assistance. I mean, it on and on it goes. And we're going to complain? You know, it's been said often, and it's so true. Go to a third world country where supper is, if you can find it, is in a garbage heap somewhere, and then complain about your existence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For the most part, as you said, for the most part in America or Europe or New Zealand, Australia, various places like that, for any of us to even begin to complain about anything, literally lightning should come from the sky and kill us on the spot. I've been in countries, I've seen places. When I was in South Africa, and I want to quote the verse in Isaiah 29, it's in the last verse of Isaiah 29, verse 24. Those whose spirits stray will come to understand, and those who complain will learn their lesson. Those are harsh words.
Yeah.
Those who complain will learn their lesson. I took a wrong turn in South Africa. It was one of those things that you thought, whoops, I just really messed up. And it was into one of these shanty towns. People don't come out of those. These were acres and acres and acres that if you had metal, if your house was tin, you were living uptown, buddy. Most of them were cardboard, pieces, scraps of wood, you know, nothing on the floor. And this was where, and there was literally thousands and thousands of people living in there. To consider that I would complain about anything in my life. You know, my coffee is not cold, is not warm enough. Really? That's what you want to go out with? You know, my steak is not. Have you ever sat in a restaurant and had somebody behind you that complained about everything? Me and Kathy had that not too long ago. It was like I wanted to stand up and say, "Shut up." You know, just walk out the door. You don't like it? Leave. Go somewhere else. The waitress will be glad to escort you to the door.
I've had dinner with people like that sitting at my table, and it's like, really? It's not sweet enough. It's not salty enough. It's not. Don't get me started.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get me started. All right. So, Mike, they are. There's a section here in chapter 16 where they set out from Elam. And they're halfway from Elam and halfway to Sinai. In other words, they're in the middle of nowhere. They just left comfort zones and shade trees. And now they don't have any fresh food and they're unhappy. They get manna, they get quail, bread in the morning and meat for supper.
Mm-hmm.
It begs the question concerning what you were just talking about. What does it take for Yahweh to make you happy? I mean, honestly, if we were to go to the Father and he were to say to us, what do you want in order to be happy? In America, we've been trading $1 million. We wouldn't know what to do with $1 million if we had it. And most of us, we had $1 million, we couldn't keep it.
Mm-hmm.
Money is not going to make you happy.
No, if money made you happy, then the guy that what was his name the last week?
Bezos. His wife's not happy.
No, she's about to become the richest woman in the world. When that settlement goes through, she will become the richest woman in the world. You know, you want to see unhappiness? These people on television that people watch every night, those are some of the most miserable people in the world. To go to, you know, your question, if the Father came to you and said, okay, what would it take to make you happy? Oh, you mean right at this moment? That would have to be the response from many. That would have to be, oh, well, if you'll give me this, then I'll be happy for this long. If I just had that car, then I would be happy. For how long? 6 weeks?
Until you had to change oil on it and pay insurance payments on it, and then you realize, oh no.
Yeah, if I just had that house, if I just had that person's bank account, if I just had this or this or this or this, at that point, I'd be happy.
Well, you know, Jan did ask somebody one time such a question. In Scripture, he asks Shlomo, basically, what do you want? Ask me anything. And he said, wisdom. And because he asked for wisdom, he was given riches and fame and esteem as well. But even wisdom, later on, he says, I've tried everything, parties, I've tried fact-finding missions, I've tried wealth, I've had building programs, and it's all vanity. It comes down to you need to learn to seek the Creator in the days of your youth.
Mm-hmm.
Wisdom is seeking Yah. I got to tell you, Mike, we have become a very spoiled society. We need a heartfelt shift. back to him. I'm thinking about the current trend of things, of the way that we worship. You know, we need lights, we need sound, we need all these things. We need catchy phrasing for our teaching. And years gone by, John Wesley would come to town and preach a heartfelt message, and towns, entire cities would change. But he was preceded by his brother Charles and a group of men that would find a cellar somewhere in the city and spend days in prayer before John ever got there. When people become broken and pray and then declare the word on top of that, an entire city can be won. Mm-hmm. It's not the feel-good message, and it's not the lights and the glamour. It's prayer, brokenness, and a declared word of Yah. We need that. We need to get back to that somehow. Mm-hmm. Off my soapbox.
I like the soapbox. I really do. And it goes back to where we started with Barry. This is about vision. It's about having a vision. And what caused most of the people to die in the wilderness is they never saw the purpose for the bones in their midst. Hey, think about that. What is
say that?
They never saw the purpose for the bones in their midst. Whose bones are in their midst? Joseph's.
Okay, I catch what you're saying. Okay. All right.
In the middle of the camp is the somewhere in the midst of that camp are the bones of Joseph, a man with a dream. A man that had been given a dream about restoration. What was the dream? You know, that you were all going to bow down to me. No, that was a prophetic event of a shadow. That was a prophetic shadow of what was going to be in the future. Though there was a manifestation of that dream when the boys came to Joseph in Egypt, that was still just a shadow of that which was coming. And that was a family that would bow down before Elohim. A family united would bow down before Elohim. So here we have a visionary in the midst. And the people couldn't look at those bones and see the vision.
Mm.
The vision of why did they go to Egypt in the first place was so the people could grow into a nation. A family could grow into a nation.
Yeah.
The vision of why they were put into slavery was to appreciate their freedom. A vision of why the plagues were there in the land, so that the Elohim that they served, or they were proclaiming that they were serving, could be set up as the one true Elohim above all other Elohims, the gods of the Egyptians.
Yes.
Why did the sea split? To proclaim that greatness. The manna coming down from the heavens. All of these things put together were in those bones. In that little box of bones was about a vision of restoration, restoration of a people to a kingdom. Instead, let's complain because we don't like the food that we got in front of us. Complain because you don't like the taste of the water. Complain because of this. Complain because of that. Complain because your steak's not as well done as you want it to be, or it's too well done. The broccoli just, it needs more salt, it needs less salt. Why couldn't they have brought me organic butter instead of this butter? What do you mean it's not goat cheese and it's cow cheese? What do you mean? You know, how insulted am I that you know that somebody didn't serve this instead of that?
I tell you what, I've been in some homes where you just had to pray to get through dinner before. I mean, it's been interesting.
Oh,
yeah. I know you have as well. There is in 17:7, Mike. The classic question. They tried Israel or tried Yahweh saying, quote, is Yahweh in our midst or not? Unquote. Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. Did you have manna this morning? Yeah. Yeah. It's a cloud there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it is. Are you in slavery? No. Is Pharaoh's army pursuing you? No. Well, then what's the problem? Well, I'm thirsty. Moshe, go ahead of the people, strike the rock at Mount Sinai, and water flowed from the side of Mount Sinai all the way back to where the people were so that they had water as they continually walked toward the mountain. Now, what else is your problem? You know? The problem is Amalek seizes those moments.
Mm-hmm.
The power of doubt and unbelief, our adversary will rise up and attack us when we're in waterless places. That Yeshua said, you know, you cast a spirit out, they'll go to waterless places, and they're going to come looking for something else. Those spirits that are out there in the waterless places are bad spirits. It's a dry, barren place, yes. Don't pick up that spirit, because it's not going to give you a conquering of your thirst. It's not going to help you any. Anyway, is Yah in our midst? Not what an incredulous, asinine question. Of course he's in your midst. But how many times have you and I reached up toward the heavens and said, where are you? And mm-hmm. why are you not listening to me? Mm-hmm. Is that not the same question? Is that not asking the exact same thing? Where are you? I've tried to be careful with that one and follow that out. I don't sense you. I don't see you. I don't find you. I don't know where you are in the middle of all of this. But Father, I'm going to try to trust you. Can you please help me here?
You know, it's not just as he, I've got something written down in scriptures. We're running out of time. It says in David Stern, says, is Adonai with us or not? And I put in, I think the Hebrew would more say, is he within us? Is he within our camp? Not just with our camp, but within our camp.
Yeah.
There's a difference between being with somebody in, you know, okay, hey, I'm with you. I'm with you in this.
I got your back.
I got your back. I love what a good friend of mine said. He said, I'll never have your back. He said, but I will stand in front of you.